Okay. Welcome to week three of the High Holidays Crash Course. And so up till now, we've spoken about a little bit about Shacharit, the morning prayer. We talked about how it really focuses us on God's sovereignty and awareness of you know, an awe of God, and our try to bring that to our daily life, which is a very difficult task. We spoke about the message of the shofar, how it's meant to wake us up and pull us out of just our natural flow of things and the limitations that we naturally place on ourselves or are born into, and help us get beyond that. And now, if you're in shul, if you're in the synagogue, it's starting to get a little bit later in the morning, and you might be starting to lose it a little bit, and you've been in shul for a while, and but really, we're getting really to the most serious part in a way, and that is musaf, which comes from the word an add-on, because it's based on an additional offering that was brought in the temple. We have an additional prayer service on Shabbat and on all holidays. So really, the importance or the significance of musaf is demonstrated by the fact that it opens with a prayer from the chazan, from the leader of services, that it's called hinani. It means behold, here I am, and basically he gives a prayer that says, you know, I'm not worthy to represent the congregation, but despite that, you know, please, God, accept my prayers on behalf of the congregation. Don't let my shortcomings affect everyone else. And it's a very serious moment, and really brings out the significance of musaf. Now, there's two parts of musaf that I want to talk about today. The first is the famous, also very serious prayer of Unitana Tokef, which means let us state the seriousness of the day. So I actually included in the source sheet much of the prayer. I'll read part of it. Let us now relate the power of this day's holiness, for it is awesome and frightening. It is true that you alone are the one who judges, proves, knows, and bears witness, who writes and seals, etc. And then I'm going to jump to where I underlined, where it says, all mankind will pass before you like B'nai Maron. And I deliberately did not translate that because we're going to get to that in a moment, although this prayer seems to translate it as like a shepherd inspecting his flock. And the idea is that everyone is judged on Rosh Hashanah. Everyone passes by in front of God one by one for some personal attention. So this word, B'nai Maron, which means the people of Maron, the prayer pulls it from a Mishnah, a work of the sages, and the Mishnah is quoted actually in the Talmud, in the next source. It says there that on Rosh Hashanah, all that come to the world pass before him like B'nai Maron. And that's in an earlier work of the sages, the Mishnah, which was written down in about the year, I think around 200 of the Common Era, approximately. And the Talmud, which is a commentary on the Mishnah, which elaborates on the Mishnah and interprets the Mishnah, which was recorded about 150, 200 years later, wonders about this word, B'nai Maron. What exactly does it refer to, that we all pass before God like B'nai Maron? So the Talmud says, what is meant by the expression B'nai Maron? And it brings three interpretations. The first one is, here it was translated as B'nai Amarna. So we're going to need commentary on the Talmud, which is a commentary on the Mishnah, to explain to us what that is. Reish Lakish explained, like the steps of the house of Maron. And Rav Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, like the soldiers of the house of David. Those were the three interpretations of B'nai Maron. And when we're studying Talmud, it's not enough usually just to read the Talmud. We need the commentaries to understand the Talmud. And Rashi is the primary commentary on the Talmud. And he interprets these three. The first one, he says, means like B'nai Amarna, like sheep, counted for tithing, which seems to be whoever composed the prayer also accepted that interpretation, because if you look back to the prayer, it says, like B'nai Maron, like a shepherd inspecting his flock. That's the first interpretation, like sheep counted for tithing, filing past in single file through a small opening, two cannot fit through together. And it's an expression of one by one, they have to pass through, and the shepherd counts each one and sets aside, you know, marks the tenth one. He's going to tithe it, donate it to the temple. That is what is being expressed by this word. The second interpretation is like the steps of the house of Maron. And Rashi interprets what is significant about those steps. So there is a narrow path, and there is not enough room for two people to travel alongside one another. There's a steep valley on either side of the path. So like, you know, like a mountain pass, basically, you're going up these steps or this hill, and the only way to get up to this house that's on the top is single file. There's no room for two people. And again, expressing, you know, that we're going one by one before God. And the last is like the soldiers of the house of David. Now, where does that come from? So Rashi again explains, like soldiers in the king's army. How does that mean? That Maron is an expression of mastery and lordship. Mar means like master. It also means bigger, actually, but it also means master. And so Rashi explains, such is the way one counts soldiers, they march out to battle, one after the other. And again, expressing this idea that we're all going one by one. And the imagery of all three is basically the same idea, that everyone gets personally judged by God, just us, you know, each of us and God on Rosh Hashanah, standing before God in judgment. And on the one hand, it's frightening, and on the other hand, it's very meaningful that God pays attention to each individual and their life and their actions. So, interestingly, we think of Rosh Hashanah as a build-up to Yom Kippur, right? It's the beginning of the 10 days of repentance, which leads up, you know, culminates on Yom Kippur, and Yom Kippur culminates with the Ne'ilah prayer. Ne'ilah means locked, and usually we understand it to mean, you know, the gates are closing, they're going to be locked, getting your last prayers, this is your last chance before your fate is sealed. But there is an alternative interpretation, which I heard in the name of Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, and that is that at Ne'ilah, the gates are being locked with you inside. Like it's just each of us and God locked in a room at the time of Ne'ilah. We've reached, you know, it's the culmination of this time of closeness with God. We've reached that, you know, really the ultimate level of closeness with God at the end of Yom Kippur. And we're locked in, Ne'ilah, we're locked in with God. And so that, though, begins here with, on Rosh Hashanah. Really, it's been going on actually throughout Elul, throughout this month, which is also a time of closeness, and that closeness grows closer and closer until its culmination on Yom Kippur. So I saw a beautiful interpretation, though, of these three analogies that are offered, that in fact, although they're all expressing a similar idea, the Talmud mentioned three different analogies in order to bring out three different ideas. So again, the three analogies are that we pass before God on Yom Kippur one by one like sheep, in a flock, like a shepherd counting his flock, or like we would have to go up this mountain pass one by one because there isn't room for two people. And the third is like soldiers going out to war, being counted one by one by their king. So starting with the sheep. So we're like sheep. So why does a shepherd count his sheep? So there are many reasons. Actually, the specific reason that Rashi mentioned was in order to count out every tenth one to tithe them. But as well, in general, a shepherd might count his sheep because he wants to make sure that they're all still here, that none of them wander off. Some of them may have run away. Even if they are there, he wants to see if they're healthy. So similarly, we can say that on Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah, when we pass before God like sheep, so he first of all wants to see if we're all still, are we still part of the flock? Have we wandered away from God and from his flock? And as well, are we still healthy? Are we spiritually healthy? Are we doing good deeds? Are we trying our best to keep the mitzvot? Have we developed good character traits? Have we developed proper ideologies and beliefs? Are we strong in our, in the observances that we keep? You know, are we working on ourselves? Are we growing? So all of these things, God wants to check. Are we healthy? Just as a shepherd counts his sheep. So that goes into the judgment on Rosh Hashanah, is are we all there? Are all the members of the flock still here? And as well, are we spiritually healthy? Then it goes on to the second analogy, like climbers going up through a narrow mountain pass. So if you think about it, theoretically, two people can be in the exact same state of being, spiritually, meaning they could do the exact same number of good deeds, they can do the exact same number of bad deeds, and they can have exactly the same character traits, the same level of belief, and similar lifestyles, and one can be, receive favorable judgment, and the other, quite the opposite. But they're exactly the same. They do exactly, you look at them, there's absolutely no differences. They're like twins. So what's the difference? So it's interesting. We find in scriptures, in the works of the prophets, that people are called walking, moving. As opposed to angels, they're called standing. There's a verse that says that God placed man between the angels, and the way it refers to man is as walkers and as angels as standing. And the reason is because people, we're on the move. We are constantly changing. We're going up and down in our spirituality, in our connection to God. While angels don't have free will. They are just messengers of God. We've not discussed exactly what we believe angels are right now, but that's the word we're going to use. But it's a spiritual messenger, but it does God's will because it doesn't have free will, just automatically. So, but we are constantly moving, and hopefully we are moving upwards. That's our hope. In fact, an animal also is called in Hebrew a behema. It's called, that's the word for animal. And if you divide up that word, beis hei, is bet hei is ba, and the second half, mem hei, is ma. Ba, ma, which means what's in it is there, meaning it doesn't change also. An animal doesn't develop spiritually, it doesn't have a free will to grow in spirituality, to connect to God, but people are constantly moving, up and down, up and down. And if we are not doing our best to move up, to grow spiritually, then ultimately we're going to end up descending. It's like walking up a downward escalator. That if you don't move, you're just going to end up back at the bottom. Or, more coarsely, it's like climbing up a muddy hill. That if you don't keep putting in the effort to climb, then we will end up sliding down and ending up very muddy. So, and that's important in our lives, is that we are constantly trying to learn more and to grow more in our spirituality and our connection to God and to his mitzvot. So that would be the second analogy here, right? So again, you have two people, as I mentioned, they look the exact same, they're doing the exact same things, but one of them is on his or her way up, and the other one is on his or her way down. They used to do much more, and they're slowly dropping everything. So even though at the moment, maybe they come to Rosh Hashanah and they're standing in the same place, they look the exact same, but one is going to be judged favorably because he or she is climbing up the mountain, while the other one is going to not be judged as favorably because he or she is slipping down for lack of effort to continue climbing. So that would be the second analogy in the Talmud, that we walk before God, we come before God one by one, like those who are climbing a mountain, that God looks at us, checks us, scrutinizes us to see if we are attempting to grow.
Now, what if the one person slips most of the time, but they happen to be climbing at that moment?
You'll have to, we'll leave it to God to be the judge.
He's climbing and he slipped at that moment.
Yeah, so it's
everyone's entitled.
Right. Yeah, no, it happens to everyone. It's, God will pass judgment, based. That's why what?
Yes.
Right.
Well, I was thinking God also knows each person's potential, so he knows what you can do.
Right.
And he may be judging you based on that if you're making the right progress.
So, and so let's get to the third analogy now. The third analogy was that we are walk before God like soldiers reporting for duty. So for this one, actually, I want to shift our focus a little bit to the second part of Musaf that I wanted to talk about, and then we'll come back to fit that in to this. So if you turn the page, the back page, there are three main sections of the Musaf prayer, or that are unique to the Rosh Hashanah Musaf. And those are Malchuyot, Zichronot, and Shofrot. So Malchuyot means kingship, Zichronot means remembrances, and Shofrot means shofar blasts. And each of these sections is composed of an opening paragraph or two that generally speaks about the idea that's being discussed, so it's God's kingship, or it talks about how God remembers everything, or it talks about the shofar and when it was blown and the significance of it. And then it gives 10 verses from scriptures, from Tanakh, about these, in each section, 10 verses. Actually, each of those 10 verses are first 3 verses from the Torah, from the 5 books, then 3 verses from the writings, and specifically Psalms, then 3 verses from the prophets, and then it closes with another verse from the Torah, from the 5 books of Moses. And that's in each of these 3 sections. You have 10 verses on that topic. So we really spoke a lot about God's kingship the first class, and we spoke a lot about shofar the second class. So I want to speak about the middle section, which is zichronot, remembrances. Now, when we say that God remembers, we don't mean that he forgets and then he remembers. What we mean by God remembers is that everything sticks with him, stays with him. He's aware of it, and when we pray for God to remember something, we are actually praying that God bring that memory or that awareness to the forefront and make that, you know, impactful. So I want to look at a couple of lines from the opening paragraph of the Zichronot section. And it says that you remember the deeds done in the universe and you recall all the creatures fashioned since earliest times. So that refers to how God remembers everything going way back to the beginning of time, the past. Then, shortly after that, we say you remember or are aware of all that is done. And that refers to the present. And then we say everything is revealed and known before you, God, who keeps watch and sees to the very end of all generations, which refers to the future. And what we're saying here is that all of these three things are important towards the judgment of the day. The past, everything that has happened in history, and the future, everything that is going to ever happen. You know, God is beyond time. God can see every moment, you know, at once. It's not something that we can fathom because we are not beyond time. But and God takes into account in judgment all of the past and all of the future and the present. Now the question though is why? Why is it important what happened all the way back in the beginning of time? What does that have to do with what I did this past year? Why is that important? So, the answer, this is offered by Rabbi Chaim Friedlander, he says that, and it's not based on his own ideas, it's a general idea that we find in other places, that besides for each individual's responsibility to strive for our own perfection, but we as a nation, as a people, also have a general mission to bring the world to its ultimate perfection. And we're all tasked with doing that. And we are all trying, through our good deeds, through our mitzvot, to bring about what really we refer to as the ultimate redemption, which is a time when everyone recognizes God. And the way that we do this is through our good deeds, our mitzvot, which make an impact, both an impact that we can see, an impact that we can't see on a spiritual level, and helps bring the world to its ultimate purpose. And it's throughout history, we're all taking part in this. And everybody has a role to play in that. Everybody has a sort of a brick to put onto that building. Everyone is created for a purpose with a mission, and sort of what Keith alluded to, you know, with the potential to make a difference and to make their impact through their good deeds. It doesn't have to be, you know, that you're the one who changes the world, but everybody has, even in their own way, their own personal mission, and we have to, try our utmost to do our part, to do good deeds, to study Torah, and learn about, performing mitzvot, and that way we can place our own brick on this building. But what we do, is really taking in perspective. If we take in perspective, we're really part of building this great building. And if we are doing what we're supposed to, so then we will be adding on to that. But if we aren't, God forbid, what instead of building on the previous generation what they've done, we are tearing it down, then that also is taken into account. So that's why it's important to take in the past into account. What role we play in this ultimate purpose is taken into account at the time of judgment, and the future as well. What will the effects be of our actions on the future? And will they play their proper role in bringing about this ultimate purpose? So that's also, what will be the ripple effect of our actions? So that's also taking into account. So the past, present, and future is all taking into account at the time of judgment. Just to bring out this idea, it's a very nice idea found in the Sefer HaChinuch, which is a book of mitzvah education, basically. It's a medieval work, but it was written for his son to teach his son about each of the 613 mitzvot. And there's a mitzvah, it's in Deuteronomy 20:19. It says there that when you wage war and conquer a city, do not destroy its trees by swinging an axe against them, for from it you will eat, and you shall not cut it down. There's actually a prohibition in the Torah to cut down a fruit tree. There may be some exceptions, but in general, we may not do that. And this is where we derive the general principle of Baal Tashlit, do not waste, do not destroy. And if you look at the Sefer HaChinuch, his words are amazing. He says about this mitzvah, again, he's teaching his son, this is written, it's of unknown authorship, but from the 12th, 13th century. He writes, and this is the way of the pious and people of proper action. They love peace and are happy for the good of all creations and bring them close to Torah. And they do not destroy even a seed of mustard in the world, and any loss or destruction that they see pains them. And if they can save something, they will use all of their power to save anything from destruction. Which really, in this time with all these natural disasters, like all this destruction, it's a mitzvah to do our utmost to save things from destruction. And certainly, it's a prohibition to go ahead and destroy wantonly for no good reason. But he throws in at the beginning here, this seemingly out of place, he says that they love peace and are happy for the good of all creations and bring them close to Torah. And that seems quite unrelated to what we're discussing. The second half fits in. It's, don't cut down fruit trees, so don't destroy even a seed of mustard. Destruction pains us. If we can save something, we'll use all our power to do so. But what is, the happy for the good of all creations and bring them close to Torah have anything to do with this mitzvah? So I saw an explanation by Rabbi Matisyahu Solomon, and he explained that if a person truly internalizes this mitzvah, so what they come to recognize is, as the Talmud says in the bottom quote here, of all that God created in the world, not one thing was created for no purpose. Right? Why are we commanded? Why is it so terrible to destroy something? What's the big deal? So I cut down a fruit tree, So I destroyed wantonly. Who cares? So what's significant is that if this is here, it means it was created for a reason. God put this in the world for a reason. If I'm destroying it, then I'm taking away its ability to fulfill its purpose. And when I recognize that every inanimate object has a purpose in creation, then I will also come to the recognition that every person has a purpose in creation, a very important purpose. And therefore, I am happy for the good of all creations. And I bring them close to Torah to help them find their path, to help them find, you know, discover how they can contribute, how they can do good deeds, and how they can help play their role in fulfilling their purpose in creation. And so that, I think, really fleshes out this idea that everyone is part of an ultimate mission to bring the world to perfection. Everyone has a mission, has an important task, and it's upon us to try to work on that, to work on ourselves, develop our character traits, perform mitzvot, and that way try to fulfill our purpose. And so that is, the message of this last analogy, going back to the army, that the third aspect of judgment, the third analogy offered in the Talmud that we pass before God one by one, like soldiers in an army, is that we all are part of this one big army, this one big team that everybody has something to contribute to. But it's up to us each to develop our own unique qualities and find our own unique way to contribute, you know, earn ourselves a medal of honor. And we are also going to be, that's part of the judgment, is are we doing our best to actualize our potential? Are we doing our best to contribute, to place another building block on that edifice that is, you know, that building that we're all creating to bring the world to its ultimate perfection and purpose? So that, I think, is the third aspect. So we talked about three aspects of judgment, three things that God will be looking for from us on Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah, and on Yom Kippur, but that we're going to pass before God like B'nai Maron, like sheep, like a flock of sheep. Are we still part of the flock? Are we still healthy, spiritually healthy? We're going to pass before Him like steps up to the house of Maron. Are we growing? Are we developing ourselves spiritually? Are we on a path of growth? And thirdly, like the soldiers of the house of David, are we contributing to this ultimate goal? And are we finding our unique qualities that we can contribute in order to bring the world to its ultimate perfection? So with that, I wish you all a year of health and happiness and spiritual fulfillment and a year of growth. Thank you.
Thank you.